Mansion, followed by weekend discussions at the governor's mansion. UW health nurses and administrators agreed to regularly discuss workplace concerns as a state agency, and the courts likely will determine if the health system can recognize a union the nurses have tried to revive since Act 10. The agreement announced yesterday at the state capitol averts a three-day strike the nurses had planned for today through Thursday. It also calls for no additional strikes as the two sides regularly confer about staffing levels, workload, and other concerns. In sports, the Brewers are in St. Louis against the Cardinals, the Cubs are in New York against the Mets, and the White Sox are at home against the Rockies, and those are all night games. In our weather, we can expect a high today of 75. For tonight, a low of 58. And for tomorrow, a high near 74. And tomorrow night, a low near 61. You're listening to WGTD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're turning our attention backward in relatively recent American history, back to the 1930s, and to a terrifying story that unfolded in Cleveland, Ohio. It was a series of gruesome murders, and they were done by someone who was completely unknown to the public, and for that matter, to law enforcement officials as well. And it would be the case of a serial killer at large at a time when that term had not yet been coined. And ultimately, onto the scene to take charge of the investigation of these bewildering and terrifying crimes was one of the most famous men in America at the time, Elliot Ness, still a relatively young man, hot off the heels of his noteworthy work in Chicago, where he played a dramatic role and much publicized role in bringing the notorious Al Capone to justice. In his position as public safety director in Cleveland, Elliot Ness shouldered much of the responsibility for trying to solve the mystery of who was doing these terrible killings one after another. And this remarkable story, largely forgotten by most of us, if we've ever known the story, is described very, very clearly in a beautifully written book called American Demon, Elliot Ness and the Hunt for America's Jack the Ripper. The author is Daniel Stashower, a New York Times best-selling author who, among other things, has written extensively about Arthur Conan Doyle, the man responsible for creating the character of Sherlock Holmes. Daniel Stashower's books also include The Hour of Peril, The Secret Plot to Murder Lincoln Before the Civil War, as well as The Beautiful Cigar Girl, Mary Rogers, Edgar Allan Poe, and The Invention of Murder, and The Boy Genius and the Mogul, The Untold Story of Television. This latest book, published by Minotaur Books, again titled American Demon, Elliot Ness and the Hunt for America's Jack the Ripper. Daniel Stashower, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
In that introduction, I failed to make mention of a couple of different personal connections that you have to this story. Explain to our listeners those personal connections that helped draw you to and made you aware of this intriguing story from Cleveland in the 1930s?
Sure, you bet. Well, I grew up in Cleveland. And when I was about 8 or 9, I remember hearing a really grisly version of this seemingly outlandish story of murder being told while we were roasting s'mores around a campfire at summer camp. And believe me when I say you didn't have to embellish a whole lot to turn this story into the stuff of nightmares. I remember the phrase, "the killer is still out there," being repeated many times. And I also remember that the camp counselor had to stop and explain to all of us what the word decapitated meant. I don't think I slept at all that night. So now it's 50 years later, lo and behold, I'm a writer who does history and true crime. And I'd always wanted to do a story set in my hometown. So it's a full circle moment. In my head, I'm right back at that campfire at summer camp, only, you know, now I'm the counselor. I'm the one telling the story. And I suppose you have to bring your own s'mores.
Tell us also, our listeners, about the member of your family who, at least as far as you can tell, crossed paths with the legendary Elliot Ness, actually more than once.
Thanks for asking about that, Greg. It was a huge surprise. I was researching the story in Cleveland. I was looking through Ness's papers and family scrapbooks, and as you would expect, there were a lot of familiar faces peering out from the clippings, the newspaper articles of the time. You'd see Al Capone and other gangsters, and also some of the era's shining lights, FDR, John D. Rockefeller, J. Edgar Hoover. But as I was paging through, suddenly a familiar face jumped out at me, and it was my own grandfather, Fred Stashower. Now, I was sure I must have dozed off the microfilm machine. I must have made a mistake. But sure enough, there he was in a row of faces. And I'd love to be able to tell you that my grandfather was a bootlegger or a bank robber. But it turns out that he and Elliot Ness must have crossed paths at least once a year at a political roast, something on the order of the Washington Correspondents' Dinner. It was called the Anvil Review. And my grandfather, I came to find out, was singing and dancing in this program for years and years. And Elliot Ness was a frequent target, one of the goats, as they were known. And apparently, Ness took it in stride. He cut out an article from the newspaper that featured a caricature of the actors involved, including my grandfather, and he pasted it into a scrapbook along with a photograph of himself with his hand pressed to his forehead, kind of doubled over laughing at the joke. I really liked that. The man may have been untouchable, but he could take a joke.
Tell us how difficult it was for you to untangle this story and to give us as much information about this story as you do. And what was most valuable for you in uncovering the wealth of information that we find in your book?
Well, the newspapers at the time were very important. They covered this story very, very closely. And in fact, they soon discovered, once the scale of the crimes snapped into focus, that the public was, as you would imagine, both horrified but also captivated. So there was more and more coverage in the papers as the stories went along. This was the 1930s, it's Depression-era America. And as you mentioned earlier, it's a string of absolutely brutal killings. Each of the victims appeared to have been beheaded, some, it seemed, while still alive. And the remains, in most cases, were expertly dismembered and scattered across the city. Now, this was a story that challenged the sense of decorum in the newspapers of the time. But as the as the story gathered force and as the public began clamoring for details, more and more the stories pressed forward with their coverage. It got increasingly lurid and increasingly gruesome.
It was interesting, as you mentioned, how the newspapers covered this, that at least in the early goings of this crime spree or series of murders, that when it was evident that a couple of the earliest victims had been castrated, in addition to decapitated. I mean, it is indeed so horrific that the newspapers grappled for how to talk about that in print, that this was a point in time when apparently one would not come out and spell that out clearly or in detail.
No, absolutely not, and especially not in a newspaper that was intended to be read by families around the breakfast table. Yeah, that that case you mentioned, one of the euphemisms that was employed was otherwise mutilated, which covers a lot of territory and left it to the reader's imagination to fill in the blanks, as it were. But no amount of decorum or delicate language or artful window dressing could really mask the terrifying scope of these crimes as they went on, because even the barest description included a pair of boys stumbling over a headless torso or a severed limb floating down the Cuyahoga River, or a skull that was found rattling around in a tin can at a city dump. It really was grisly stuff. And as it went on, the headlines became more and more heated with calls of outrage and demands for action. There were headlines like, "The Mad Butcher Strikes Again," and "Torso Killer." Well, he's that almost unknown creature, a master criminal. And he added, "It can be argued powerfully that he was the greatest murderer of all time."
And again, this is happening at a point in time when the term serial killer has not yet been coined. But this is certainly an example of that. By no means the first example of that, and the infamous Jack the Ripper just one of a number. But still, it is good for us to be reminded that this was at a point in time when this kind of series of crimes, which we assume was done by the same perpetrator, that this was still something that the public, generally speaking, had a lot of trouble wrapping their heads around, even apart from the horrific nature of these particular murders in Cleveland.
Yes, in fact, it took a while before the police even realized that they were dealing with a series of connected crimes. But at one stage, some remains were discovered barely a mile away from where two other bodies had been found a few months earlier. And the scale of the thing just snapped into place for everyone. An investigator told the press that he and his detectives were on the trail of what he called a crazed killer with a flair for butchery. But as you indicated, this is the 1930s. Modern forensics and techniques like criminal profiling, things we recognize today, still very much in its early stages. But the Cleveland police, under the direction of Elliot Ness, threw everything they had at it. And they even improvised new techniques at the time as they tried to push through the limitations of their resources and technology. The coroner brought together a panel of experts to produce what they've called a synthetic portrait of the killer. Today we would recognize that as profiling. They did the best they possibly could, mounted an absolute pedal to the metal manhunt to do everything they could to bring to hunt this killer down.
We're speaking with Daniel Stashower about his book American Demon, Elliot Ness and the Hunt for America's Jack the Ripper. Before we get to Elliot Ness himself and the nature of his investigation and, of course, a bit of his background, which you chronicle for us in your book, it's probably important for us to spell out the sort of victims that were the targets of this serial killer. Because this was part of what made a lot of this difficult. in terms of the investigation. And even ahead of that question, we get the sense from reading your book that more than one of these victims was ultimately never conclusively identified, again, because of the horrific nature of these crimes and what was done to the corpses, which left very little for investigators wanting to know who this unfortunate person was who had been murdered.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. This had a lot to do with the crimes unfolding against the background of the Great Depression. At that time, in the city of Cleveland, as elsewhere across the country, a number of homeless encampments and shanty towns were springing up. And in Cleveland, there was an area called Kingsbury Run, a very gloomy thread of land that had once been an ancient riverbed. And it became the home of displaced people, itinerants. And these were people who seemed to, the killer seemed to be preying on these people. People who were homeless, who moved from place to place, people who would be very hard to identify, and people who would not be missed. And that's one of the reasons why it took some time before the police and investigators realized that they were dealing with interconnected crimes. What the killer had been very canny in preying on people who not only would be hard to identify, but also who wouldn't have people looking for them, at least not right away.
Hmm. As I read your book, one of the sort of mistaken assumptions I made was that because the victims were, as you describe, kind of people from the other sides of the tracks, or, I mean, people maybe crossing paths with unsavory characters or whatever. I mean, these were not luminaries of the city that were the targets of this serial killer. I mean, not to say that these weren't still terrible murders, but in a sense, in terms of who the victims most likely were, it was, in a sense, people far away from a lot of the public of Cleveland. But the fact that these remains would show up, not always on the kind of the wrong sides of the track, so to speak, but ordinary citizens were coming across this kind of terrible, gruesome evidence again and again. As I read that, then I started to realize why, yes, this had to strike terror in the hearts of every single person living in Cleveland, even if you lived in the wealthiest, most posh kind of neighborhood, presumably far away from where these crimes were occurring. This still had to be a terrible fear for everybody in that city.
There were points at which people, ordinary citizens, as you say, were all but literally tripping over remains as they were being discovered. And as you can imagine, that was absolutely terrifying and fanned the flames of this climate of fear that gathered around these crimes. There was a lot said about the fact that at one stage, if it had been a chain of city councilmen who'd gone missing and were found terribly mutilated in this way, that the police would have been quicker to act and would have mounted a more vigorous investigation. But honestly, while I understand the point that was being made that some lives, the idea that some lives count for more than others, was being rejected in the newspapers, I honestly feel that the police did everything they could be done, no matter who the victims were. Again and again, I was struck by the extra hours that the police were putting in, by the heroic measures that they went, and their absolute determination to leave no stone unturned.
Hmm. We're speaking with Daniel Stashower about his book, American Demon, Elliot Ness and the Hunt for America's Jack the Ripper. We've waited long enough. It's time to talk about Elliot Ness, mentioned in the subtitle of your book. And I was so glad that you took the time to give us as much background on Elliot Ness as you did, because he's actually somebody that I don't know as much about as I should. And the little I knew about Elliot Ness and what made him so famous, a lot of that I had forgotten for one reason or another. So I appreciate the fact that there is such extensive background there in terms of what made him so famous with his work in Chicago. One of the things you say, this is actually in the introduction in your book, is that the Depression created a vacuum in which the underworld thrived. Can you just briefly explain what you mean there? What is the correlation between the Great Depression and the economic ravages that it sort of inflicted on the American public and the underworld thriving? How do those two things go together?
It had a great deal to do with the Great Depression, and even more to do with Prohibition, which was the 18th Amendment ratified in 1919 that established the prohibition of intoxicating liquors in the United States. It was believed in some quarters that a ban on alcohol would help the country to address poverty and other social issues. Now, a whole lot has been written on this subject. As a congressman of the time declared, it was a ghastly farce. And one official said that enforcing the laws was like trying to dry up the Atlantic Ocean with a blotter. But the job of trying to enforce these laws fell to prohibition agents like Elliot Ness. And he, in particular, tried to bring diligence and integrity to a bureau that was generally thought to be incompetent or corrupt, and no particular love for the temperance movement. And he himself was not immune to the charms of alcohol, but it was the law. And Ness was very alert to what he called the sinister offshoots, the unintended consequences of prohibition, that it allowed more serious forms of crime to flourish because so many police and politicians were on the take. And it allowed the underworld to gather power. It had put power into the hands of the mob, allowing them to grow even stronger with other forms of crime, gambling, prostitution, racketeering, the types of things that expanded into a network and really created a problem and a demoralized police force, where even when the police were not on the take, they were powerless to act. That was what Ness believed, and what I was talking about with a vacuum that allowed the underworld to flourish. So when Prohibition was finally repealed, it had left a huge cleanup job for Ness and other agents like him.
Right. As you chronicle Elliot Ness's work with the Prohibition Bureau, and the way in which he went after all kinds of people, but ultimately, of course, Al Capone. I love the moment where you explain what was a real breakthrough in terms of trying to find a way to strike at the heart of Al Capone's operation. And you describe it this way: the breakthrough came when the team began to focus on the shell rather than the pea. We shouldn't take a lot of time with this, but I just find it so fascinating. Can you just briefly explain those intriguing words to our listeners? Because this was so important in bringing Al Capone down.
Capone had risen to power on this tidal wave of beer, ministering to a $20 million a year thirst. But he had to be very careful to protect all the elements of the pipeline that he was using to supply illegal alcohol to his customers. And Elliot Ness and the Untouchables and his team found it very hard to track down the location of these breweries that were popping up all over Chicago. Ness said that the breakthrough for him came when they learned that instead of trying to follow the beer, they should follow the barrels that were being used to deliver the beer, because Capone's brewers and brewery workers were washing them out, sterilizing them, and taking them across town from place to place so that they could be reused. Ness and his team discovered that if they followed a truck with barrels around the city, going from place to place, often very carefully transferred from one route to another over the course of several days, eventually it would lead them back to a Capone brewery. And that's how they made their first raid, and many more that followed.
Hmm. One of the things you do in your book is explain how there is some difference of opinion on just how crucial a role Elliot Ness specifically played. Was some of that blown out of proportion? And how much of that is his own fault versus the fault of others kind of blowing him up into this legendary figure? And you do explore some of that in your book, as well as explaining to us what ultimately came of Al Capone. Ultimately, Elliot Ness resettles in Cleveland to become the director of public safety there. And this is a very different job. I mean, in Chicago, the work for which he is most famous, he was overseeing a very small team. In Cleveland, he was overseeing the police department, I think, and the fire department. I mean, and I'm guessing hundreds, if not thousands, of employees. This is not the kind of position for which he was necessarily naturally equipped nor experienced enough to properly handle.
No, and not only had he never been in charge of thousands of city employees before, he'd never faced an administrative challenge like that. He was also the youngest person ever to hold the position in Cleveland, so it was a real struggle for him not only to fill the requirements of the job, but to live up to his own reputation, to fill his own shoes. As it were. His marching orders when he came to Cleveland, when he was appointed the director of public safety, were to clean up a police department that had basically rotted from within because of corruption, and also to try to break the stranglehold that the mob had over the city. No big deal. Clean up the police force, take down the mob. And the wonder of it all is the degree to which he succeeded. He had the backing of the entire city behind him. His timing was terrific. One of his reporters said that the city had seldom needed a hero so badly.
Hmm. One of the most fascinating points you make in your book, when Elliot Ness is ultimately entrusted with the investigation into this elusive, terrifying serial killer in Cleveland, is the striking difference between this challenge versus the one that he faced in Chicago. This is how you write it. The job of the Untouchables, that's of course Elliot Ness and his famous team, the job of the Untouchables had been defined by a clear, highly visible target. Al Capone was the most famous man in the city at a time when Ness was entirely unknown, leaving the young agent free to move in the shadows. Now the script had been flipped. Ness was the most famous man in the city, and his quarry had the advantage of anonymity, able to strike seemingly at will. Nothing in Ness's background had prepared him for this. I've never stopped, would never have otherwise probably realized it, but this was in some ways exactly the opposite of the challenge he faced in Chicago. Tell us what he did to try to meet this kind of unprecedented personal and professional challenge.
Well, the Ness from television would have strapped on his holster and kicked down some doors. But this was a problem that couldn't be solved by driving a truck through the doors of a brewery. Now, it's important to understand that in any other city, the job of trying to track down a killer like this would not have fallen to the director of public safety. He wasn't a homicide detective. He wasn't a fireman. He wasn't a crossing guard. He was the guy at the top of the pyramid. And he did the things that the director of public safety was supposed to do. He allocated extra resources, extra manpower. But this was Elliot Ness. He wasn't content to leave it there. People expected action. They expected heroics. Ness had made a point of saying that he would lead from the front lines. And over time, as the pattern of the crimes gathered force, he had to step in. He said, I'm going to do all I can to aid the investigation. I want to see this psycho caught. So he put together a team. And he worked side by side with them, often outside the system and under the radar, trying to get information off the criminal grapevine so that they could run this killer to the ground. Hmm.
Well, your book ultimately is a fascinating chronicle of his efforts and the efforts of others to try to unravel this daunting murder. And we're going to leave it to our listeners to explore the story further and to ultimately discover whether or not this elusive serial killer was ultimately identified and brought to justice. It's a fascinating story, very, very well told in this brand new book, again titled American Demon, Elliot Ness and the Hunt for America's Jack the Ripper, published by Minotaur Books and the author Daniel Stashower. Daniel Stashower, congratulations on giving the world yet another riveting book. Thank you so much, and thank you for being my guest on The Morning Show. It was great to talk with you.
Thanks so much. This has been a real pleasure.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview from The Morning Show archives. And now we turn our attention to an outstanding novelist who comes out of the heart of America's Midwest, Janice Agee. And perhaps you know her from some of her previous best-selling novels. Her fifth novel has just been published, and it's called The River Wife, published by Random House. And it tells the story of a woman and actually several generations of women essentially living on the river and living a tough life and a life in which there are things that are very ominous just beneath the surface. And it's a very intriguing subject matter and setting. And we're going to talk with her for the next few minutes about her new novel. Janice Agee, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be with you.
Good to have you here. You are, I believe, born and raised right in the heart of the Midwest. Tell us a little bit about exactly where you come from.
Well, I was born in Nebraska, in Omaha, but my family's from Missouri, where this book is set, and actually we spent a lot of time down there. My mom kind of ran back and forth between Omaha and the middle of Missouri down by the Ozarks.
Hmm.
So, and then I worked for almost 25 years up in the Twin Cities in St. Paul, Minneapolis.
Oh, you do know a lot about this part of the country.
Yeah.
I spent my high school years very close to Omaha, and then I went to graduate school in Lincoln.
Oh.
So I know Nebraska pretty well, and I enjoy rising to its defense when anybody wants to kind of make fun of Nebraska or
Kansas.
Well,
there's a lot to make fun of, but we're good people out there.
Absolutely. At what point in your life did you entertain serious thoughts of becoming a writer?
It was kind of always there in the back of my mind. And I think in high school, I kind of made a plan for myself. And I realized I started as a poet, and I realized poets never make a dime. And so I decided I needed to become a teacher to, you know, so I'd have a day job and support my writing. And I went to graduate school and got a graduate degree. And I do teach at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln now.
Oh.
So that was kind of going back home for me a few years ago when they hired me away.
Right. So Lincoln is where you make your home?
Actually, I live in Omaha. I commute to Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And and I just always knew I was going to do this. And then the writing of novels and fiction occurred when I moved back to the Midwest. It was very interesting.
Very good. I feel like one of the things I'm grateful for when I went to graduate school in Lincoln was that's where I first became acquainted with the name of writer Willa Cather.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'd not ever heard of her until I was a graduate school at Lincoln.
Yeah.
I imagine for someone like you, she has to loom as some kind of inspiration.
Oh, absolutely. She is the Nebraska writer. There are a few others of us now. And now we have Ted Kooser, who's the poet laureate of the United States. And there are more and more writers, and there are more and more writers everywhere. It's wonderful what's happening with writing these days. You have a lot of good writers in Wisconsin, of course.
Yeah. Well, I think most people would think that any kind of a novel that's set in Missouri
cannot possibly have too much in the way of excitement, that surely it's going to be a fairly lazy and idyllic sort of book. And, of course, that is, first of all, to misunderstand this part of the country, and it's certainly to underestimate a novel like The River Wife. I mean, this is exciting stuff, and much of it comes right out of the real-life history of this region.
Absolutely. It starts with the Great New Madrid Earthquake in 1811, which was the greatest earthquake North America has ever experienced. And it's that time when the Mississippi River actually ran backwards because the floor of the river dropped so profoundly that it reversed the flow for a while. And then it goes on through the Civil War. We cover Civil War. There were a lot of activities down there. And then up into the 1930s, there was, of course, bootlegging. And we're on the river, so there's river pirates, there's gangsters, there's a lot of frontier life. It's, you know, it's about people trying to build, the main character, Jacques Ducharme, who is this kind of patriarchal figure, is trying to build an empire, and he lives forever in this effort, and he's willing to do almost anything to make money.
Right.
So with that kind of desire, he wreaks havoc on a lot of lives.
Right, especially the lives of some women, and we'll talk about that in just a moment.
Okay.
Maybe help our listeners understand how we're using the word pirate, or what sort of piracy we're talking about.
Yeah, it's not the kind of Jolly Roger flag. It's a term that was used for the men who lived along the river, and in this case there's a woman involved too, and there were women involved, who would waylay the river travelers when river travel was one of the main means of getting around. So the paddle boats, steamboats, the rafts, would have to put to shore, and there were a lot of this kind of behavior, piracy along the Illinois River, the Ohio River, the Mississippi River, and during the 19th century. Hmm. And it was good pickings, as they say.
How so? What do you mean?
Well,
by that?
That was the main mode of transportation. It was faster than going by land, and so a lot of goods were shipped, and a lot of boats were wrecked.
So the potential is there for kinds of booty.
Oh yeah, yeah, and that's exactly what good old Jacques Ducharme was up to. He was a French fur trapper who was involved in the Great Earthquake, and the earthquakes of New Madrid lasted a year. There were over 2,000 quakes during that time, and so it was really a pretty wild and woolly time. And he rescues a young woman who is trapped, and this was a true story. There was a young woman I found when I was reading historical documents who was trapped in her cabin by a roof beam that smashed over her legs, and her family abandoned her to the rising river. And the town of New Madrid eventually is taken by the river and disappears. Mm. And I couldn't stand to leave her there. I couldn't find out what happened to her, so her fate was unknown.
You mean if she was ever rescued?
Absolutely, and she kind of hangs there in time, and so my own obsession created a rescue for her. She simply haunted me for a year until I decided to write the book and save her life.
Wow.
So she becomes the first river wife.
And let's talk for a moment about that really intriguing term. It's something which ends up fitting five different women whom we meet through the book. But first, just tell us about that term, river wife.
Well, to me, the book didn't have a title for a long time. You know, it had other titles, Jacques Landing and, the house at blah, blah. And eventually it seemed to me that whether they were married to Jacques or not, that the women who accompanied him during certain periods of his life in his great climate, kind of plundering of the world, became his wives. And so they became the wives on the river. And it just had a kind of ring. And the cover echoes that. The cover is of a woman who's kind of sunk into the water, and you don't know whether she's rising or falling.
Hmm.
And I think that's a good description of the way some of these lives are being lived. And
absolutely.
Certainly driven by love, which seems like, sometimes you're up and sometimes you're going up and sometimes you're going down.
Mm. We're speaking with Janice Agee about her fifth novel, just published, called The River Wife. We're talking about a region of Missouri, right across from Tennessee, which I think is called the Boot Heel region. Tell us a little bit more about this little bit of country.
Well, it's an interesting piece because a lot goes on down there. There was, it's that little tail that hangs down in Missouri that looks like it belongs to Arkansas or should belong to somebody else. And it's a very fertile area, of course, because it's riverland. And there's a lot of cotton now down there and a lot of rice. And yet it's New Madrid, and this area has the largest oxbow bend in the entire Mississippi River. So it's a place where the boats have to slow down traditionally. And, of course, that led to good piracy, good robbery opportunities. And it's a place where they would stop and refuel, you know, gather wood, et cetera. So there was a lot of kind of wild frontier life. It's also a place where one of the major battles for control of the Mississippi occurred and during the Civil War. Hmm. And there were some really fascinating kinds of historical moments there that I discovered and involved my characters in, it's kind of a rough and tumble place. Mm. You know, it's life along the river, and rivers are always, they're the thing that drives our country. Our country is about rivers, and it's wild over there.
So your book has, in some ways, at the heart of it, the most recent of the five women whom we examine, who sort of finds herself in the midst of this region in 1930, marrying Clement de Charme.
Yes.
Who would be a descendant of Jacques. Tell us a little bit about this woman you've created at the heart of your story.
Well, she was the first voice I really heard in the book.
And how do we say her name?
Hetty de Charme.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hetty.
And she... When I wrote the first version of the novel, I wrote her as an 80-year-old person in 1990. And eventually, you know, I worked my way back in time to tell the real story that I needed to tell. And she's very young when she marries Clement. She encounters him at a hotel in her in the town, in the middle of the state where she grew up. And Clement is very seductive, and he really likes young women, and it was very easy for him to kind of capture her heart, and she eventually gets pregnant and comes to stay with him, and they marry, which is the good thing about Clement. I think he really intended to be a good man, and of course he couldn't ultimately, but she discovers not only her own strength, but she discovers the lives of the other women before her in the house that she moves into, which is the house that Jacques Ducharme built, and through their stories, she begins to kind of see a repetition of her life and perhaps her fate, and yet she survives and becomes stronger and stronger and outlives them all, as it turns out.
The one of the points made by one of the reviews I read of the book is that you have created for us this quintet of heroines who do not loom larger than life. But that these feel like real life women. I mean, human beings, flaws and all. And I thought that was really an interesting point because, of course, there is always the tendency, I think, when one writes a novel, to be creating kind of Mount Rushmore figures, and rather than flesh and blood human beings. Talk for a moment about that, and if indeed that was your intention.
Well, when I write, I always try to write people, you know, to write people and not just characters. I'm very interested in the complex nature of us, how we are always a combination of good impulses and dark impulses, and that struggle is what produces who we are in the world, the struggle to be one or the other, to be better than we are, perhaps, or as good as we are, and to sometimes the effort to be as dark as we can be. Mm. And I think that the women that I see around me are driven by the impulse to love, to do all those kind of conventional things, but they're also very complex people who have all those forces working within their nature. And I like to write about people who actually do have struggle in life. I'm not very interested in writing about ultra-rich people who don't have their backs against the wall in one way or another. And so my characters are always people who have to work in the world and who have to work to make themselves something and to be heard. And, you know, that's just what I'm interested in, and that's what I see in the world of people. And so I'm very grateful if they seem real as opposed to simply characters.
Right. It seems to me that something else that is surprisingly universal is that we're talking here about women who are sort of living on the edge of darkness. I mean, who maybe at first aren't absolutely certain, but come to be more and more certain that there is sort of evil lurking right around the corner. I mean, that the man to whom they have devoted themselves is maybe not who they hope he is or think he is or wish he was. And what one does with that when you believe that there is this darkness within the person you're sharing a bed with. And that, of course, plays out in all kinds of different scenarios. I mean, right down to the young wife in an inner city who's afraid her young husband is involved with a gang or something. I mean, the details can be completely different, but that essential story plays out to this very day in all kinds of interesting and sometimes tragic ways.
I think that's absolutely true. There's no way to prepare oneself for what one will discover when you become close with another human being and when you begin to share the bed of that person. I think there's a kind of unveiling that goes on, and it may take years, but eventually you get to know the nature of the person you're with and in all its glory and sometimes not glory. I think the effort to not see the truth about another person is a huge effort and really flaws the person who is in that position of trying to blind themselves to what they're seeing. On the other hand, what do you do with the truth? Mm. And I think that's what determines the moral nature or the character of one's life.
Absolutely. When, of course, especially what does one do in at other points in time when maybe the alternatives are not a simple matter? Or
absolutely. Yeah.
There may be a very limited array of options available.
That's true, and particularly if you're struggling for survival, just mere physical survival.
Right.
Which I think people did for a long time in this country and are still doing in other countries.
Just a quick word about one great challenge in writing a novel like this, which is when one writes something which is intergenerational like this or multi-generational. What did you do to create such cohesiveness in this book?
Well, that was a real problem because, you know, I had to figure out how to twine the stories. And it seemed that, you know, I come from a family that has, for generations, kept family books. And so it just seemed natural to me that there would be these kind of books where stories and the histories of these lives would be recorded. As we do now, every generation in our family has someone basically tacitly assigned the job of keeping track and writing it down. And so that was the way I decided that these women would get to know about each other's lives, that they would read these explorations. And I decided to, instead of having very separate books, I decided to have the story unfold in a third person as Hetty is reading it. And it seems that there's just, because everything's occurring within the context, you know, of this one house, and that there's a certain kind of repetition of activity that occurs. You know, everything's very different from one period of time to another, and yet there's certain things that never change. And that's what I think the women come to realize.
The book again is called The River Wife. It's the fifth novel of Jonas Agee. It's published by Random House. And Jonas Agee, I'm so happy that we had this chance to have a conversation about your wonderful new book. And best wishes to
you and
with all that's ahead for you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a conversation about how we are coming to think about and understand gender very differently, thanks in large part to the collective attitudes of the